listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast with your host, Andy Plimer. Bringing you up-to-date coaching concepts from the world of rugby. Sharing ideas to make the game better.
Okay, welcome to episode number 68 of the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. I'm your host, Andy Plimer, and joining me today is Andy Friend. Andy is head coach of Connacht Rugby in Ireland and has been coaching professionally for 24 years. Before Connacht, Andy has had head coaching roles with the Aussie Men's Sevens, Suntory Sun Goliath, the Cannon Eagles, the Brumbies, and the Harlequins. It's a pleasure to have him on the show, so welcome, Andy.
G'day, mate. How are you?
Yeah, great. You?
Yeah, going well, thank you.
Yeah, how's sunny Galway?
Today is a sunny day. It didn't start sunny, and yeah. That's probably the way Galway works, mate. It's four seasons in a day sometimes, but we're loving it here. And as I say to people, we didn't come here for the weather, so it doesn't get us down. But we're really enjoying it. Good people and a good environment.
Yeah, perfect. And we'll definitely spend most of the time chatting about that. So I really keen to find out more. Just to kick us off, what's your playing backstory and how did that turn into coaching originally?
Many moons ago, that since I was playing, mate. I've been coaching now for 24 years, as you said there before. Yep. But listen, as a junior, I played, started my rugby over in London, in England, actually.
Yep.
When I was 13 years of age, we lived over there for a year and a half. That's where I started playing. Came back to Australia when I was 14 and sort of played all through the ACT. I played Aussie schoolboys for a couple of seasons there. Mm-hmm. Like every young rugby player, had the goal and the ambition to play for the Wallabies. Had a couple of pretty serious knee injuries that pulled me up pretty early. So I used to play for Royals in Canberra.
Okay.
Played for the Kookaburras when they were around ACT. Yeah. Kookaburras, but finished playing the rugby when I was about 25. And at that stage, I realised with a knee that I had that I probably was never going to make it. So started coaching around that time, and so thankfully stayed in the game of rugby and been doing that ever since.
Yeah, great. And what those first coaching experiences? What were they like? Were they with the club side, or what? How'd that roll out?
Well, really early on when I was still at school, I was involved with coaching younger kids coming through. Yeah. But my first paid gig, if you like, I was on a $25,000 stipend. I was at the Institute of Sport,
right?
Coach on scholarship there, and we had seven players in our program, full-time players. Four of them people probably haven't heard of, but three names that people will know about. One was Justin Harrison. He was in that program.
Absolutely.
One was Joe Roth, and one was Stephen Larkham. So that was in my first ever year of coaching at the Institute of Sport. They were three guys that I was working with and had an involvement with, and sort of went on from there.
So what was that like, individual skill work, performance planning and things like that?
Yeah, it was they were part of the Institute of Sport program.
Mm-hmm.
So the Institute of Sport used to run a really healthy rugby program, and it was a satellite program. We had seven players in Canberra, and I was working out of Canberra. There was about 20 players in Queensland and 20 players in Sydney. So all up, there was close to 50 players on scholarship. I was the coach on scholarship down in Canberra, Scotty Wisemantle and Adam Leach. So Scotty Wisemantle is now working for England as their attack coach. They were working out of Sydney, and David Clark was working out of Brisbane. So that was back in 1994. That we were doing that, so a long while ago, and sadly the Institute of Sport doesn't have that program functioning anymore in Australia. But it delivered a lot of good rugby players.
Yeah, you're not wrong. Just those names alone, and the coaches as well. The benefit there is pretty huge. You spent some time over in New South Wales as well with the Waratahs. What was that like?
Yeah, well, I left the Institute of Sport after it was only a year. I did a graduate diploma there, and mm-hmm. and then went to the Waratahs. I started off there as my title was Developing Elite Teams Coordinator.
Yep.
So I looked after pretty much anything underneath the Waratahs. Chris Hawkins was the coach at the time. Then Matt Williams took over as the coach, and I, after a couple of years, I became the skills coach with the Waratahs. I did that through till 1999, and then I took off to Japan. I was I applied for a job that was at the back of the Sydney Morning Herald, and a team called Suntory were looking for a backs coach. And when I wrote in, I realised that the bloke who'd put the ad in there was Eddie Jones. So I met with Eddie in a hotel in Sydney. He was coaching the Brumbies at the time.
Yeah.
He offered me the job to go over for 8 weeks, went across there. I really enjoyed Suntory. They seemed to enjoy what I was doing, and they offered me a three-year gig at Suntory in Tokyo.
Yeah, so was that before or after the Harlequins?
Yeah, so I did that. I was coaching coordinator there for 3 years,
right?
1999 to 2002. We had three really good years there. We managed to win the national championship in Masala. Drew it in the second year, won it undefeated in the third year, and then following on from that, I was then employed back with the New South Wales Waratahs as their assistant coach underneath Bob Dwyer.
Yeah, okay.
So I worked with Bob for a couple of years. At the same time I was working with Eddie. Eddie was the Wallaby coach, and I was working with him as the technical advisor was my title. So I worked with him for the 2003 World Cup year.
Mm.
And then in 2004, the end of 2004, well, Ewan McKenzie had come in actually after the World Cup. But Ewan and I parted ways at the end of 2004. It was my first sacking as a coach. So I left the Waratahs December 2004. I picked up a gig with the Aussie Sevens for 2 weeks, which is my first taste of Sevens rugby. And then myself and Chris Hickey were appointed. Chris was the head coach. I was the assistant coach of the Aussie under 21s. And we took the Aussie team to Argentina, to Mendoza, played in the World Cup over there. And we got beaten by South Africa in the final. So, but we had some quality names there, the likes of Cameron Shepherd and Adam Ashley Cooper and Digby Ioane and Julian Salvi, Tafu Politanau, yeah, some big names. James Horwell as a quality side, and just a great experience.
Yeah, it's been a long time between drinks too for the Aussie 20s now. For moving in that direction, they seem to have restructured a lot of things too for this time around. So definitely, it's an important piece of the puzzle in terms of player pathway for Australian rugby.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we used to do very, very well, we used to have the genuine pathway coming through for players and for coaches. But I think with the advent of Super Rugby, the focus became on super teams, and maybe we took our eye off the ball with those younger pathways. Certainly, one of the things I've seen here in Ireland is the way they support grassroots rugby is very, very different to what we're doing there in Australia at the present, and something we can learn from.
Yeah, and I'll definitely touch on that later on for sure. Just backtracking a little bit to your time in Japan, you spent two stints there, and it seems to be a bit of a go-to place, not just for players, but for coaches as well. From your experiences there with Suntory and with Canon, what would be some advice you'd give to coaches who are thinking about taking the leap and heading over to Japan for a period?
Well, I think it's... I think it's always good to stretch yourself and to coach in different environments, and in an environment where the language is not your first language of choice definitely makes you think about your coaching a lot more, because you don't have the opportunity to waffle. You have to be very direct and you have to be very succinct with your message. So, and the other thing about Japan, they love training. So when you're looking for hours as a coach, and it's all about hours in the seat, in the saddle, like, you will train more in Japan than you'll train anywhere else in the world, purely because of their compulsive nature of wanting to be better the whole time. So, in the 7 years I had there, it was probably the equivalent of about 12 to 14 years of coaching back in Australia, where you just had time in the saddle.
That's great. That's awesome. Yeah, it'd be exciting to go into that total culture change and really just get stuck in. After your time in Australia and with Eddie and with Bob, your first head coaching role was with the Harlequins in England. What was that learning curve like, becoming a head coach for the first time And, you know, what were some of the things you had to adapt in terms of how rugby was played in the UK compared to in the Southern Hemisphere?
Yeah, well, listen, that was a unique experience too. So we had, in European rugby, they've often got a director of rugby then head coach. Mm. So yeah. We had that there at Harlequins. Harlequins had just appointed a new director of rugby, Dean Richards.
Okay, yeah.
And Dino invited me over for an interview on the day we met. It was the last day of the 2004-05 season. Harlequins were playing Sale, and they had a shot at goal that if they kicked the goal, Harlequins remain up in the Premiership. If they missed the goal, they pretty much get relegated. And we were sitting behind the post. The kicker missed the goal, unfortunately, and Dean Richards turned to me and said, "I'm not sure whether we'll be able to go through with this contract now, friendy." So I flew back to Australia 2 weeks later. Harlequins had been relegated, but 2 weeks later I got the phone call saying, "Listen, the board still want Harlequins to fight on. It's a very proud club. We will go through with the contract. So if you'd like to accept the offer, please come back." Which we did as a family, came back to London. Right. So my first year with Harlequins, we were in the Championship. We won 35 out of 36 games, got ourselves promoted back up into the Premiership.
Nice.
And then had two really good years there, working with Dean and with John Kingston and the other coaching staff there, Colin Osborne, and some real quality young players at the time there. We signed young Danny Kerr. Mm. No one had heard of Danny at the time. We had Mike Brown and Chris Robshaw and George Robson, Jordan Turner Hall, these young fellas coming through the academy. Nick Easter was there. We signed Dave Streddle. Now household names, a lot of those fellas, but that was the young group of players we had coming through, and just sort of embarked on a really exciting time for Harlequins, and it was great to be a part of that for 3 years.
Yeah, awesome. And what do you think? What's the Premiership do really well that Southern Hemisphere rugby could adapt to and bring into their game? Do you feel?
I just think the nature of the tournament here, it's more a marathon than it is a sprint. Super Rugby was always a sprint. It was you had to be ready for round one. Especially when it was Super 12, when it went to Super 13 and Super 14, it was just so crucial that you won those early games. In the Premiership, you're playing 26 games a year, plus another championship, whether it's European, plus another Power Gen Cup or whatever. It was Power Gen Cup back then, but there's so much football, so it's probably not as frantic. I think the other big thing with European rugby that I learnt, the set piece is so important, because during the months of December, January, February, it's very, very hard to play footy. So you needed a strong set piece. You needed to have a tactical and game element to your game, which I'd probably never seen before, because, being in Australia and Japan, it's all about hard surfaces and just moving the footy and, playing a lot more ball in hand. But European rugby taught me that there's a lot more about the game in terms of the set piece and being very tactical in how you played it.
Yeah, that's great. That's key. All right. Awesome. So, and then after Harlequins, you moved back to Australia and then took on the Brumbies coaching role. What was, that experience like? And, how was the adaptation going from the UK back to Australia then? And, that was probably just after the, what were we then? Probably 2005, was it?
2008, yeah.
2008, so where I was Aussie rugby struggling a little bit at that time.
Yeah, we came back, and listen, that was probably the dream job because I'm a Canberra boy. Mm. So to come home to my hometown, and, like I said, I played for ACT Kookaburras before the Brumbies started, and if there was a team I wanted to coach, it would have been the Brum. So to get that position was... it was brilliant. It was a real honour, and came back in and built what I thought was a really strong team. Mm-hmm. We had a good coaching staff around us, but learned a lot of lessons there. Learned a lot of lessons around culture and around getting other people's buy-in rather than trying to inform them as to what the value should be. Mm-hmm. Had two good years. Like only lost two games at home in Canberra, but mm-hmm. lost some other games. We had some real awkward times during that period too. We We had the death of Sean Mackay, which over in South Africa, which was a really tragic period for my coaching and for the club and for Sean and his family. We had some good wins, but some tough times too. But two games into my third year there, I was sacked again. So that also again, you know, part of being a coach, I believe you. We work in an environment where we're continuously judged. I made some errors, no doubt about that. But I also learn a lot about trust, and I learn a lot about making sure that you have the right people around you. I took a year out of coaching after that. Mm-hmm. My wife had an accident, so mm-hmm. we took a year of trying to get Kerry right. It was just a good reflective year, actually, where I spent time with the family and, started to realise that a Friday or Saturday or Sunday result is not the be-all and end-all where it probably used to be. But it does put things in perspective when those things happen to you. And ever since then, I've been a lot calmer coach, and I don't get too worked up if we win or lose.
Yeah, oh, that's great. That's some awesome lessons there too for coaches who face disappointment, whether it be a loss or being asked to move on, is, you know, you got your family and you got, you know, your wife and your kids, and that's more important than anything when it comes to the big picture, right?
Yeah, definitely, mate. I remember having a reporter say to me at one stage there after the Brumbies, he said, you'd be one of the easiest blokes to talk to, friendly, but you're not successful. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you've never won a Super Rugby title. I said, is that success? And he said, yeah, surely. I said, well, in my eyes, it's actually not. Like, you know, I don't want to go to the grave being judged on how many titles I've won.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't define me. You know, I want to be judged upon the bloke I was to people, the father I was, the husband I was.
Yeah.
That's more important to me. And I think, again, when I was asked that question, I got that response. It made me sit back and say, wow, is that what people view success as? Because I am a rugby coach by choice. I'm a bloke, I'm a bloke. The bloke I am is by choice too, but that's what I'd prefer people to remember me as.
Yeah, I guarantee that's not the general viewpoint across all opinions, that's for sure. And I think you're spot on there. I think about that too, the amount of coaching time I spend away from my family. I really balance it out. My wife's really good for that too. When if I've got a couple of teams overlapping, and, you know, I'll get the tap on the shoulder and it'll be a conversation. I think, you know, you need to have that support and that person around there to say, hey, let's take the foot off the gas a little bit here.
Yeah, I learned that in Japan too, mate. It's, you know, I said I worked with Eddie there, and Eddie's well known for his his attention to detail and his ability to leave no stone unturned. But what I learned in Japan, if I wanted to spend 24/7 analysing games, analysing opposition, talking to players, talking to coaches, I could do that, and I'd still never get it all done.
Yeah.
So I learned pretty quickly, you know, life's about balance and life's about priorities. And yep, I'll spend a lot of time, and I have spent a lot of time focusing on my coaching, on my players and the team at the time. But if I stay doing that, I've got a short lifespan in it. So I just try and get balance as best I can and prioritise the important things that need to be done and in terms of work, but also find time for myself, find time for my wife, find time for my family, for my mates. Really, really important.
Yeah, key. Awesome. Okay, and then I'll briefly touch on the Sevens, and then we'll jump into Connacht. Your time with the Aussie Sevens. How was that coming from a 15s coach into a Sevens role? You said you spent a bit of time there earlier. How was that adaptation, and what are your takeaways that you apply to 15s from the Sevens game?
Yeah, I spent 2 weeks there in 2005, so it wasn't a great deal of time. I was in Japan. My wife had moved back to Australia. There was an opportunity. I was contacted by Australian Rugby Union at the time, Rugby Australia Now, to say, was I interested in a Sevens gig? I said I did have an interest in it because I did follow the Sevens, and I enjoyed the format of the game. When they offered me the job, it was very, very different. I loved it. I seriously loved it. I just think it's a brilliant format of rugby. I find the speed of it is incredible. I find the energy of it and the accuracy of skill technique is really important. There's actually a lot of, you know, tactically there's a lot to the game. But I fell in love with that game, and probably the other part of it, you know, you're such a tight-knit group of people, so it becomes an extended family to you. Other programs do too. Like, I think one of the things with coaching, you give your heart and soul to the people you're working with. But Sevens, because it's a smaller group, you actually become more intimate, and there's a lot of good young men that in Australian rugby anyway, they were the young men that no one else wanted. So they had a point to prove, and they were doing it because they believed in themselves, and they believed in playing for their country, and they believed in going to Olympic Games and the Commonwealth Games and playing on the world circuit. So, we formed a really good bond with those young men, and it was really disappointing when I left there.
Yeah, no doubt. And, the performances were really good when you look at across the time span that you're involved in there, and you know, being an Olympic sport, that just takes it up that level of intensity too.
We did have some good performances. You know, we were building too. We were building, and it's part of a 4-year plan that I had in my head. I took over the gig seven months out from Rio. Post that 7 months, we went to Rio. We didn't perform the way we wanted to. We ended up coming eighth at the Olympics. So at that stage, we had 26 players in the squad. Over the next 12 months or 18 months, we moved on 21 of those players. So the new squad that we brought in was a brilliant young group of men. And the plan was to keep the whole group together there for 4 years and to take them to Tokyo and hopefully win a gold medal. Listen, sometimes the best laid plans don't come off, and as it turned out, it wasn't meant to be. But they are a good young group of men, and I do wish them all the best for their chance in Tokyo.
Yeah, for sure.
If they get there now.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, on the flip side of that, you're in Connacht now, so that's the bright side of that story. What's I've been following you on Twitter, and you've like fully thrown yourself into. You know, not just the rugby, but also, you know, you've been to a few hurling matches and some Gaelic football, and just really immersed in the culture. What's a bit of a description of the rugby landscape for Connacht, and you know, what are some of the strengths and challenges of that region?
Well, firstly, mate, Connacht's the west of Ireland, so our team represents the whole of west of Ireland. Yeah. You know, the five counties of the west of Ireland, and awesome. They are really passionate people about their region, and therefore about their footy team. You know, there's a real community feel to Connacht, which I love. I love the fact that it's not just about the top team. It's, you know, we have a slogan which is grassroots to green shirt. So there's time spent at the grassroots level to get young aspiring men and boy, or boys and girls who want to play for their province, to give them a clear pathway to get there. They're very, very passionate about the west of Ireland, the region they're from. The Connacht itself, the rugby club itself, is led really well by Willie Ruan, who's our CEO and a board of directors. Three big rocks that they believe, or they stand for. One is ambition, one is belief, and one is community. So, those three things are wheeled out all the time, and it's not just words on a wall. They actually believe in it. You know, they have massive ambition, where they want to take the club. Through a new stand that's just been agreed to put to build in the next few years. The belief within the organisation that we have every right to stand with the other three provinces in Ireland.
So you're going to notice a bit of a change here in the audio. I lost Andy on Skype while we were recording the interview, and then when we did reconnect, I forgot to hit record, so we had to go back and redo a little piece. So Andy will come in now, and you'll just notice the sound's a little bit different, but keep enjoying the interview. Cheers.
What are some of the areas of your coaching you feel have evolved since arriving in Connacht?
Oh, I think the main thing, mate, is the current role that I'm playing as the head coach here. Very, very different to what I've done previously, and certainly very different to what I was at the Aussie Sevens. Aussie Sevens, I was the head coach. I was the only coach, really. We had an S&C coach. We had a physio. We had a manager. We had an analyst. The last year of my coaching role there, we did employ Jared Hodges, who was a half coach, half manager. So Jared did have some voice there. So, you know, I was able to share the roles and responsibilities there with him, which was brilliant. But I was very much hands-on in the Aussie Sevens role. I've come here to Connacht, and we have three very, very good coaches in their own right. Two of them are Connacht men, Jimmy Duffy, who looks after the forwards and the contact, and Nigel Carolan, who looks after our attack. Then we have another man in Peter Wilkins, who's an Englishman, spent some time in Australia too with the Reds. Mm. He looks after our defence. So with three young, really quality coaches, I've taken a bit of a back seat, and I probably more just manage there now and let those men coach. You know, we have a lot of conversations around our structures and what we're doing there. I certainly have input into that, but those fellas do most of the talking and the on-field stuff now, which is very different for me as a coach.
Yeah, that's great. And you re-signed them really early doors too, which is great for stability and moving forward.
Well, again, when I got there, I was aware that this was their last year on contract. Mm. I've been that assistant coach where, all those men have got wives and kids. Mm. And, you know, one of the things with coaching, it's not the most stable occupation in the world, but where we can provide stability, I believe, you get the best out of people. So really early on, I said to these men, listen, I'm very aware this is your last year on contract. I really enjoyed working with them in the preseason. I said, however, we haven't played a game of rugby yet. So I want to take the first 6 weeks. After the first 6 weeks of competition, we will know whether we work as a group. And if we do, I'll let you know and we'll sign you up. And if we don't, I'll let you know and we probably won't sign you up. Mm. But thankfully, our relationship remained intact and the working relationship was brilliant. We have a great way of challenging each other, yet respecting each other's areas of strengths. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty easy after 6 weeks to say to all three men, really enjoy working with you, would love you to stay on. And thankfully, all three returned serve and said, we'd love to stay for any. So we've signed everyone through for another 2 years. So it's a pretty happy camp.
Yeah, that's great. And that sounds really healthy. And like you said, it's, you know, great for those who have family and, you know, aren't just kind of looking over their shoulder for the next, you know, 6 months. So that's awesome.
Yeah, I think, and again, you know, in the professional game, we've also done the same with our strength and conditioning staff, led by Dave Howarth, another Aussie. Again, extremely competent, very professional strength and conditioning coach. But his two assistants, Johnny O'Connor and Barry O'Brien, we've signed them through too. Some of our medical staff, Dave Hanley, we've signed him through. So it's just a really good feel there amongst the group at the moment. Mm-hmm. We've had that time together. We know we work together. So why put anyone in doubt? Make a call, give them the support, allow them the stability, and from that, you'll be rewarded in their work ethic.
Yeah, awesome. That's great. Just touching on, you know, what's a day, like a week at Connacht during the Pro 14, what would that look like if someone came along and audited what you guys were doing, and how would that look from between game to game?
It's probably pretty standard with most other pro programs, mate. Monday's our major review day. So we'll come in on a Monday. We do our monitoring in the morning. As a staff, we have a very early 7:30 meeting. When I say very early for Australia, it's not very early, but in Ireland they tend not to get up too early, so I think it's very early for over here. But one of the unique things we do there, one of our promises as a staff is that we continually grow. So every Monday, a staff member will, at the end of the meeting, will do a 10 to 15 minute presentation on something he or she has learned. Right. And would like to share with the group. So that happens every Monday. We go from there into a coaches meeting where the game's reviewed. All coaches will have done their review on the Sunday, but it's just a brief synopsis in the respective areas, attack, defence, set piece, contact. And our analyst, we'll just get all our ducks in a row there. It takes about an hour. I then go to a leadership meeting with our leaders. We have a half-hour leadership meeting there. And the players at that stage, around 9:30, they're coming in and doing their monitoring, checking in with how they've pulled up after the weekend. We go into a forwards and backs review sessions, crossing over with their strength and conditioning. We have lunch. We then come back in and do a full team review. And then out onto the training field for either touches or clarity or walkthrough, something reasonably low-key normally. But the players tend to get out of there around about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So a pretty full day of meetings and discussions. Tuesday then becomes our defence day. Again, initiated in the morning with a meeting into an on-field session. We name the team on a Tuesday as well, so that the players are informed if their status has changed. If you're in the team the previous week and now you're not, you'll get a text, and that text is basically says to come in and meet with me, and I then inform you whichever way it is, and for the reasons either you're in or that you're now not in. We put the team up, that's announced to the group. We provide our themes for the week, and then we go out and train. The afternoon is spent reviewing that session in the morning, and weights. Wednesday becomes a personal development day, so it's not a day off. We've purposely said that it's a personal development day, and that could be a range of things. It could be that you're part of the leadership program and there's a leadership course going on, or there's a we have a mentor program too. We could be doing something with the mentors and the mentorees. It could be that that's your day of study and you're off studying. It could be that you've got additional strength conditioning work, you've got additional recovery work. It could be you're doing absolutely nothing. It depends upon the person, but it's not seen as a training free day, which used to always be called. It's a personal development day, which I think is an important distinguishing feature of it. Thursday then becomes our attack day, where we as a coaching group tend to take a bit more of a back seat. Friday then becomes our game callers meeting into we call it a game prep or a captain's run traditionally, where again we actually take a massive back seat as a coaching group. Most of our coaching's already been done, and then we head into, if we are traveling, we'll travel that day. If we're at home, then we the boys head out and have a lunch at a venue around town. Again, Galway's brilliant at supporting the team, so an organisation or a restaurant or a bar will put on a feed for the fellas, and they're going to have a team lunch, and then the rest of the day is theirs. Into when 2 hours before kickoff, we turn up the next day and get ourselves ready for the game.
Great, sounds awesome. Sounds busy, and no stone unturned as well. So that's really comprehensive.
Yeah, I think it's a neat little combination of allowing people to still be people, and but at the same time having a pretty clear process there, which makes sure our reviews are done and our previews are done, and we put the adequate amount of work into our game predominantly. I think that's the other big thing in the week. We spend 90% of the time on us, not necessarily opposition, but we've had that time to know what it is we need to do, and then we hopefully get them in the physical and mental state to go out and perform.
That's great. And last thing on Connacht, they've a lot of success bringing academy players through into the senior ranks. What are some of the things that the club's doing to get that area right?
Well, we've got a great academy system. Eric Elwood leads that, and they've got a couple of quality young coaches in Mossy Lawler and Ambrose with him there that lead that. To me, that's the most important part of a program, to be honest with you. I'll call it the vegetable patch, but if you've got the right vegetables growing, mate, you're going to be okay. So you've got to spend time and energy on that, on the right people in the academy. You won't get it right all the time, but it's all linked to the succession planning that you do at the top end, and you need to know what gaps you've got coming up in your succession planning. You need to know that the people you're putting in there, you honestly need to believe that they can be professional footballers. Now, not all of them end up being professional footballers. That's life too. It could be injury. It could be, form's just stopped, or a belief or whatever. But if you do your homework right at the younger age group and you get the right people in, you can save yourself a lot of money and you know you got your success in your own hand.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, well, last question before wrapping up. We kind of touched on it earlier. You've been fortunate enough to see how two national systems align their structures with their respective provincial teams. What are some of the areas in the Irish national system that you've been really impressed with and that they're doing really well?
Well, I think the main thing, mate, it's everything. Well, my view on it is that every province, there's a genuine desire to support the national program and the national team. So, yeah, if I get a phone call from Joe Schmidt, which I tend to do at least once a week, and Joe will say, you know, player X is, we need him to be rested friendly, or you know, we've got a concern, I'll respect that, I'll listen to that, and where I can, I will make sure that we do support that. There's been the odd occasion where, you know, I've been asked to try and rest a player, and for a reason that we actually don't have anyone else in that position. I've had to ring Joe back up and say, mate, we've had two injuries in that position this week. I'm going to need to play him, to which he understands and respects our viewpoint too. So there's just a really collaborative approach from, I can only talk from my side of it, but from as a provincial coach heading to the, you know, to the national coach, I would love to see Joe successful and the national team successful. Similarly, he would love to see Connacht, and I'm sure Leinster, Munster, Ulster successful too. So there's a, you know, it's a group of four who all pushing towards getting the group of one, which is, they call it the team of us over here, the Irish team functioning, and I think it's really healthy.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, some good messages there. All right, well, we always end the show with the same final four questions. When you were a youngster and you first really fell in love with the game of rugby, who was one of the players that you really looked up to?
Listen, when I was growing up, mate, Michael O'Connor would have been
that
bloke. Mick was a Canberra boy, a Royals boy. I probably more remember him as a rugby league player, because he went across pretty quickly. But he was certainly
Manly,
a player,
right?
That
was he Manly?
He was, Manly. Played a bit of St George as well, but he was certainly a player that I loved watching. And I just thought, you know, that, again, being a Royals boy and a Canberra boy, he was pretty special.
Yeah, no, he was a beauty for sure. And what about now? Who are some of the players going around that you're impressed with how they go about it?
Well, mate, I've been really fortunate to coach a lot of quality footballers, but I'd have to say the bloke that continues to stand out and continues to impress too is George Smith. He's just one of the most gifted rugby minds that I've ever seen. If you look at stats and you look at beep tests and you look at GPS, he doesn't feature in any of those. But watch the man play the game of rugby and his ability to be in the right spot at the right time and to have an impact upon a game is just phenomenal. So, you know, in an era where he came through, you know, with the likes of a Phil Waugh and a David Pocock and a Michael Hooper, and internationally, Richie McCaw, George just continued to front up, and he's 38 years of age now. He's still playing professional rugby over here in England, and he's a freak, mate. He's a freak.
Totally, yeah, total legend for sure. Awesome. And third question: you've brushed shoulders with a number of high profile coaches. Who are some of the ones out there that you respect what they're doing and like the way they run their programs?
Listen, Eddie's had a massive influence on me. You know, Eddie gave me a chance over in Japan. Yeah. I've always respected his work ethic and the way he goes about it, in terms of leaving no stone unturned. I don't always agree with some of the things that he does, but I know why he's doing that, and I know that he's such a competitor and he wants to get the best out of people. So. And he wants to get the best out of himself. For me, the bloke that is perceived to know everything but still keeps searching for the answer, they're pretty hard to not respect.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and final question, what about some lesser-known coaches around the region or that you're familiar with who deserve some recognition?
Well, I mentioned the three coaches that we've got there at Connacht. But listen, I'd say to any person who's out there coaching, well done, because you're giving back to the game. And you know, rugby's got an amazing hook that if you can't play it anymore, the next best thing is to try and coach it and to give back. So, it's probably to all those volunteers out there too, mate, who never get the accolades of doing it. But I think one of the things that you have as a coach, you have the power to influence and you have the power to support and to hopefully make people better people. So if that's your modus operandi, that's why you want to be a coach, well, hats off to you and you're doing the right thing.
Perfect. Awesome. All right, Andy, well, I really appreciate your time, giving up, a bit of your evening to chat rugby. And, I'm a Connacht fan. I love the style of rugby that they play, and, all the best for the rest of the season. And I hope you guys get through and end up in the playoffs.
Thanks, Andy. Appreciate that.
Beauty. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review via iTunes and keep listening for the next episode. You can also follow us via Twitter at RugbyCoachesCNR or via the website therugbycoachescorner.com. Until next time, keep sharing ideas to make the game better.